Welcome to the Corporate Venturing Insider Series, where I interview top practitioners in the CVC world and learn with you the best practices and golden nuggets that they have accumulated over their careers. This week, we are recording from GCV in Monterey, where we would be learning from Jennifer Webb, Investment Director at Swisscom Ventures. Jennifer, welcome.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
Thank you. So let's start with your journey into corporate venturing. What was it?
Yes, my journey to corporate venturing. Yeah, I totally didn't imagine that I would be in corporate venture at this point in my career. So I started off in strategy consulting, actually, with Deloitte in London, now quite a long time ago. And then pretty quickly, I moved into the venture scene. So that was back in 2014 now. It was really with a view to combine a few of my sort of passion topics, impact, and also long-term relationships with my clients, as it were, right? My companies. This is something that I wasn't really getting from consulting. And I found that like long-term equity investment would be the right way to become really the guide for my CEOs. So found my way to impact and financial VC back in 2014 and found my way to corporate venture sort of 5 years after that to join Swisscom.
Okay. What it is that you use from your time in consultancy that you use today?
Oh, great question. My time in consultancy was really about the offline to online transition. So, for example, we worked with Smiths News, the largest print media distribution company in the UK, whose print distribution was declining 6% per annum. And I think that is one of the sort of major insights that I bring to what I do today, which is around these sort of transition waves. So digitalization has obviously been a major investment trend for a long time, offline to online in terms of software and SaaS investing. But then increasingly, the next wave, or at least the one I really wanted to pick up on, was sustainability. Sustainability being the next digital wave. And that like digital kind of permeates through our core business, right? Or every business. And so seeing that trend was something I really wanted to work on. And then now I think you can see it happening again with AI, right?
Very nice. So let's talk about Swisscom Ventures, just to set the scene. Yeah. What is Swisscom Ventures? What is Swisscom?
Yeah, sure. So Swisscom, it's the national sort of telecommunications carrier for Switzerland. It's also one of the largest software integrators in Switzerland as well. So overall, the business is about 8 billion, I think, and about 4 billion is a B2B software these days. So it's a very big business. It's a very important flagship national brand. Yep. As well. It's partly government owned. And one of the things that drew me to Swisscom overall was its commitment to sustainability. Joining Swisscom Ventures, my role was to lead our sustainability investment theme, to catalyze our sustainability related investments, not just for the core business, by the way, and I'll explain what Swisscom Ventures is in a second, but also knowing that our value creation aspect is Swisscom and this B2B network, this idea that you can take a scalable software business with a sustainability impact and then scale it across Swiss businesses got me very excited. But yeah, so Swisscom Ventures, what we do and our history is quite long, actually. So Swisscom Ventures started in team with our founder, Dominic Maigret.
Yep.
And it was never really formally approved within Swisscom.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it was never really formally approved. So somehow Dominic got his hands on a few million, and the idea was to make disruptive telecommunications related investments actually here in Silicon Valley or close to here in Silicon Valley and take them back to Switzerland and scale them through the Swisscom network. And the first standout success was with a company called Quantenna that we backed here in Silicon Valley in 2009, went from zero to 100 million of revenue in 9 years and IPO'd. And that was really the founding basis for Swisscom Ventures.
From a success story.
That was our first success story. Yes. And because we were never really formally approved within Swisscom, actually reaching that kind of, say, financial independence was very key to our survival. And so that was achieved quite early. And what do we do now? As we've progressed through the VC world, investment thesis has broadened. So we started to do quite a bit in enterprise software investing in the 2010s. And of course, that was with the view of leveraging the Swisscom software business as well. And then milestone moments were 2018, when we raised our first external fund. So one of the unique things about us is that we're a multi-LP vehicle. So in the first fund, we had 19 LPs, primarily Swiss pension funds, but also some corporate pension funds. And that was really because we needed more money to compete on the venture market. And as I mentioned, Swisscom wasn't giving us that much more money at the time. And then second fund now, so we're investing from a 300 million fund today. Our investment strategy remains, I would describe it as B2B software quite broadly, and then anything in the communications value chain from semiconductors up to satellites.
With a sustainability angle for each?
Yeah, sustainability clearly cuts across everything. And we look to find that now in all of our companies in some way. But then also we make specific kind of sustainability related investments as well.
Now, clearly, very few CVCs do multi-LP funds. I think you're the first good example of it. But you work like a financial VC, and then you add value, strategic value. So let's talk about the financial VC discipline, because that's what we talked about last year.
Yeah.
How do you approach it in a way that people perceive you as a CVC, but actually you're really financially VC-minded?
This is one of the things that we continue to grapple with. And I don't know if we've exactly got the balance right, but the way that we express it is, yes, the investment strategy is financially driven, and the way that we behave and operate is sufficiently free from typical, let's say, corporate or bureaucratic constraints that we can deliver it on the space and timeframe of a typical VC. The value creation is for afterwards, right? It's as a follow-up. We do our best to drive it, but of course, the tail doesn't wag the dog, right? We are the kind of, let's say, scanning function a little bit for the tanker, but that the tanker takes time to move.
But I'm sure you have a few examples where you did shift the tanker.
Yeah, we have some really interesting cases. There's one from the sustainability case, which is close to my heart. So one of the first things I worked on was the carbon accounting theme. So back in 2021, when I joined, we were looking at decarbonization platforms that we could scale across our customer base and deploy with our business customers. Now, in the end, we didn't actually end up investing into the theme, but we did get the business sort of collaboration functioning very well. So we have a partnership with a company called Sweep, which we're rolling through our sort of B2B enterprise customers today. And that's been a great example of like collaboration between our two groups. In other cases where we have, for example, portfolio companies, Yoko is a great example. Yoko is a Swiss scale-up working on expense management solutions. And they've been in our portfolio now for a few years. But recently we've signed a joint go-to-market agreement with Swisscom. We have a joint value proposition for Switzerland and the Swiss B2B customers. And also Swisscom itself is getting close, let's say, to adopting the solution as well. So yeah, we do have success cases.
Very nice. And what I'm hearing is that it's not just access to Swisscom, but potentially Swisscom's customers.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, that's actually more what we offer, to be honest. I mean, Swisscom as a customer, it's there, but of course it's slow, just like any enterprise. What is actually far more nimble is our B2B customer base. So we have developed a commercial team within Swisscom Ventures. We have three people whose day job life is to help our portfolio connect with the Swisscom B2B machine.
Like if it was a product from Swisscom.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. So once they get formally registered, we have, let's say, some control within our own hands, which is very important. And the other thing they do, of course, is really look for that tessellation to the B2B key account managers. So Swisscom has over 100 key account managers across all industries and across all locations in Switzerland. We also have footprint in other countries as well through subsidiaries. And we connect our portfolio to the relevant key account managers, depending on the industry of focus. And then beyond introductions, of course, you can deepen partnerships over time where there's mutual value and interest. Mm-hmm. I mean, Swisscom can play the role of anything from reseller, which is pretty light touch and limited effort from the Swisscom side, all the way through to co-branded, co-managed delivery. So consultative sales, implementation, integration, troubleshooting can all be handled by Swisscom if there's real value there.
Very nice. And I feel like there is a golden nugget about this three people team, commercialization team. Do they come from Swisscom or do they come from external?
They come from Swisscom, I would say. Okay. I mean, so two of the three are Swisscom Ventures employees,
yeah.
And one of the three is a Swisscom employee doing the kind of bridge.
And so what is success for this commercialization team?
More case studies where we have more, let's say, deeper partnerships delivering more value to our companies, I think is the objective. But we already do have quite a few like very good cases. So
very nice. And so when is a handover between the investment team and the commercialization team? And here what I'm trying to think about, is the commercialization team already involved at the investment decision-making process or was it at the end?
No, I think this is where, so they're not involved in the investment decision process. We do, let's say, so they get involved post-investment and they do an onboarding and there we really begin to find the roots for value. What does the startup want? What can we feasibly deliver? And we begin a relationship. And sometimes that relationship takes like 6 months to get to where it needs to go. Sometimes it takes a few years, but we always continue to work, right, collaboratively on that. So that's how it works for us. Our investment, let's say, screen, when we invest internationally, takes that into account to a greater degree. So when we're investing in Silicon Valley or Israel or indeed even in Europe, our value proposition is typically like what we bring as a strategic. So that screen is included in our scope. How it get that really is what gets us into the tier one deals. When we're investing in Switzerland, part of our role is to develop the Swiss ecosystem. We take a broader approach. It's not the case that we need any kind of strategic sign-off for any of our investments in Switzerland.
Very nice. Now, let's talk about Swisscom Ventures today. So you mentioned the size of the fund, your partnership. So you have three partners now. Mm-hmm. How is it working in terms of decision-making and structuring?
Mm. Yeah, so actually we have five partners and now three managing partners. How does the decision-making work? Well, we have two main stage gates in the decision-making process. We go through what we call a shortlisting, where we really present the investment thesis and whether or not that proposition, investment proposition, makes sense to us. That involves the full investment team, and it's really providing feedback to the deal team to see whether or not that investment makes sense. The second stage gate is partner-led decision around the investment memo. So, of course, we all participate in that discussion, but at the end of the day, it's a partner-based decision whether or not that deal goes to IC. And then finally, we have the IC decision.
Which is consensus-based, majority-based?
Majority-based.
Okay.
Majority-based. We prefer consensus, let's say, but it's not essential to have 100% consensus.
Very nice. And then in VCs, speed matters a lot.
Yes.
And especially when you source in Silicon Valley. How have you managed that structure and that process to be very responsive?
Yeah, this is in our DNA. It's been our edge, I think, from the beginning, I would say, because we've known that in order to get into these great deals, we have to be able to move quickly. So if we need to do something within 2 to 3 weeks, we have done it. And those things, if we can get them, like, we can make it happen.
Which is part of the genius of Dominique, the founder.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about the transition, because some CVCs need to change ahead of CVCs. And your transition is very special. It's public, so it's announced, which is really a partnership. So can you talk about what are the things that you thought was really well done, maybe in the communication or the process?
So it feels a lot to us like continuity. Although Dominic has really been our figurehead up until now, it's been very clear that our investment operation has been a partner-driven decision-making model.
Yep.
And everyone has, say, contributed there. Each of those partners have contributed a significant amount to the success, be that in track record or in fundraising. And so, yeah, for me, I think it was handled well. And it's internally as well as externally, it feels very natural.
It felt very natural, like a non-news.
Yeah.
Yeah, very nice. Now, let's talk about investment discipline. How do you decide on the reserve? Because you're a multi-LP fund, so you have pension funds, they want financial returns. So how do you think about the reserve allocation and how do you think about follow-on investments? And do you have any tips for the audience about how to do follow-on investments well?
Yeah, This is a very interesting area. So look, I mean, I think reserves are very hard to manage and get right because you're really trying to predict portfolio performance, right? And also portfolio cash need. And I think in this environment in particular, it's been very hard to predict that we would go through these few years of difficult venture funding and lots of companies needed internal support across the market. So look, the way that we do it is that we reserve at least exactly the amount that we invest upfront for every company.
1 euro to 1 euro.
Yeah, that's the minimum. And of course, the investment sort of director partner can extend that if they want. So for the earlier stage companies, we sometimes reserve more. If it's a capital intensive business, clearly we would reserve more. But in general, 1-to-1 is the minimum. And then how do we manage actually making the decisions around that? So of course, we have frequent portfolio reviews, which provide us with that sentiment of how well are these companies performing? Which ones do we want to continue to support? I think the main discipline, though, comes with these follow-on decisions, which we decide on every follow-on as if it's a new investment. So does the return profile of this investment make sense, given our performance requirements for our LPs? And that is really the main focus for us. So if we believe it can deliver 3x plus, we still will back those companies. And yeah, I think we have a very good track record of backing our portfolio.
Nice.
Yeah.
Let's talk about sourcing. You're investing globally.
Yes. Yeah.
This is very hard to do. So how do you do it?
Yeah, it's harder and harder to get there fast enough. The market becomes so competitive and it becomes really increasingly challenging, right, to do that because you see large investments being made at early stages in really high potential founders that don't even have a company set up yet. And so you really do need like a data-driven approach.
Now, one of the support you do is board. So how do you handle board? Do you think about observer or full board membership? How long do you want to keep the board seats?
Yeah, we have, so with international deals where we're typically following, we're maximum observer, sometimes not even more. It's important that we have majority or clear investor rights, right? Important investor rights, but it's not critical that we hold these board roles. Where we're investing closer to home, where we're leading rounds, of course, that comes with board director positions. And the way, so it depends basically on our role in the round and what we want to achieve and the value that we can bring. How do we manage that within the team? Most of us or the partners have around, let's say, 5 to 8 board roles. And then, for example, I actually have one with our main portfolio. We, let's say, divide them, but we're not encouraged to take on too many. You know,
if anything, 8 boards sounds like a lot.
It's a lot. And it can get a bit much, right? Because you have to balance kind of portfolio versus new investments. I've actually turned down quite a lot because at the end of the day, you really want to do the ones where you can spend a lot of time and add a lot of value rather than dilute your efforts.
That's a golden nugget.
Yeah.
I think many people take on board because they think they keep impactful, but actually you're diluting your impact.
And then I'm a big believer in staying for as long as you're adding value and you're really contributing to the board, great. If you're not, let's move on, right? The boards need to stay fresh. They need to move also with new investors coming in. You have to allow space for that. So at the end of the day, it's not a vanity position, right? It's like you're there to provide service. Yep. Once your role is done,
it's a position of service.
Yeah.
Let's move to another hot topic, which is generative AI.
Yeah.
How are you thinking about it and where do you see the opportunities moving forward?
Yeah. So, yeah, in some ways, it's the way that we look at this is AI as a major enabler, right? And it has been already for a long time. And so I don't want to collapse the AI conversation just to generative AI because I think it's almost a little bit narrow. But the way that we look at this is so, is this innovation, like, is it truly defensible? What's been created? Can it generate long-term value? So we see a lot of innovations in the AI space at the moment, which we're not convinced are fully defensible because with a lot of these innovations, they're very publicly available in terms of the academic research. or they're very niche and narrow, and they could be maybe replaced by alternatives. So we're really still looking for those companies which maybe embody those kind of AI first principles, but have managed to box that in such a way that value is protectable and enduring.
No, it's good. I want to go back to the multi-stage investment.
Yeah.
Many VCs who decide to invest early would say they hone the skills of assessing the entrepreneurs and their grit and their passion. And when you're more late stage, it's more about the management team, the products, the market, and so on. When you're multi-stage, you need all the skill set and that granularity.
Mm-hmm.
How tough is it?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, we have people in the team that are more, let's say, more happy on the earlier stage and people who are happier on the later stage. But yes, different questions are asked for earlier stage versus late stage. And you have different signals that you pick up on. And I think it's, again, it comes down to that kind of expertise within the team to say, with this type of company in this type of industry, like, these are the signals that matter. So, yeah.
Good. How about you? How do you assess the entrepreneur? How do you interview them? How do you do it?
Oh, that's such an interesting question. Always evolving your sense for what you're looking for in entrepreneurs, right? But early on, I interview them. I ask specific questions which help me understand what sort of person they are. I like to assess whether or not this person is a growing person. So how much have they learned on their journey so far? I also assess how they make me feel in particular contexts. So I also look for people with a bit of edge, right? I can't remember where I read this exactly. You're looking for someone that you wouldn't necessarily be totally happy if you were stuck on a life raft with them. Is in the sense of someone so driven and so capable that they could, I don't know, throw you off the life raft if they wanted or needed, right? Because you need a bit of edge. Yeah, you need a bit of edge. So it's not about, sometimes you're obviously always looking for brilliance and intelligence and people who are great with teams.
That's a golden nugget. I like this one.
Yeah. So look, I think you're looking for people with a bit of edge, and there's got to be something that signals that to you. So
very nice. And then when you look at that entrepreneur, that founder or co-founders with a management team, what are you watching in terms of interaction with the management team? Mm-hmm.
One of the key things to look for is the alignment between the management team. So asking the same question to the management team and seeing if you get same responses, I think is one of the easy ways of assessing this. Are they all aligned on direction of travel? I think that's very important.
And I'm looking at the go-to-market now, which is a more later stage, but how do you interview potential customers or potential partners? I think there's a trap of confirmation bias. You like the startup, you like their product, you do the customer interview, but you're looking for the customer saying, yes, this is going to help the problem.
Yeah.
How do you keep the discipline or the best practice for customer interview?
Yeah. So the way I do it, and this is back from my Deloitte training when we did this for every sort of commercial due diligence exercise we did, everything is in Excel. It's all tabulated. Same question to every customer. Scored at the end. These are the major themes. Recently, I was doing this for a company. It's like in that particular case, blurred. So we had some customer calls. They weren't actually customers of the company, but a potential customer in the industry. And that one wasn't supportive. So it's like being honest with yourself, really, and getting it out on paper.
Yep.
Data-driven, you can't really avoid. If you sit down and really look at it and go, was that really an interview which supported my investment thesis or not? Then you can crack through the bias. But I think you have to be quite disciplined about how you do it.
I like the spreadsheet approach because, one, you're going to have the same questions for every interviews, and you're going to be able to compare per question, which really means don't go to a customer interview and swing it.
Yeah.
Really prepare well in advance.
Yeah.
What makes the best customer interview?
What makes the best one? I think, so personally, I like to start broad and set the objectives and also really begin with the person's breadth of experience and then dig deeper from there. I also deal with things in a way of beginning of the relationship between the customer and the company, chronologically to where it stands today. I find that's helpful for the person on the other side. And then I always wrap up with a numerical question, a bit like an NPS.
That's very good. Now, a cheeky question. You go back to 2014.
Yeah.
What would you tell Jennifer to become an even better investor?
Oh, my goodness. So we haven't talked much about where I started, but I started at like a first-time fund in the impact space. The impact, we actually looked at the investment strategy, and it's about 1% of the deals in 2014, maybe in those first few years, 1% of the total deal flow was impact.
It was niche.
It was very niche. And so it was hard. But now impact and sustainability related deals are 20 to 30% of the deal flow, right? What would I say to myself? I think it's important to make like bets like that, right? With when you're investing and with your career, you have to make bets where things might not always be clear.
Great segue for my last question then. Yeah. What it is that are your bets for the next 3 years?
Bets for the next 3 years. Well, one of the areas where I spend quite a lot of time looking at the moment is sustainable computing, or how do we do this in a more energy efficient, high performance, but energy efficient way. And also in a way that doesn't store up problems for later. It reaches, let's say, unsustainable levels. And with the current trends, it looks like that will become even more unsustainable going forward. So, yeah.
Great. Jennifer, thank you so much for sharing so much about your journey and what you've learned along the way.
Thank you.
Thank you.